Doc Rivers continues to time and time again not get it when it comes to getting... Oh!
Let him play!
He wins. Great steak. Smells like poop.
Honestly, like, if Urban Meyer wants to come to Connecticut, bring him on. I mean, come on. I'll take him, too.
Nia Jackson, I think, weighs 280 pounds.
Oh!
Can we isolate that clip? Nia Jackson weighs 280 pounds. Oh!
Let her play.
From Los Angeles, this is Dave in the City, brought to you by Locks of the Week Radio. Now, here's Dave Medina.
Good evening, sports fans, and a pleasure to have you here for the big golf show. There's been a lot of bizarre behavior lately in the world, and there is certainly some bizarre behavior on that final nine at Bethpage Black Course on Long Island. Boy, what a crazy afternoon that was. We're going to recap the whole thing with John in Connecticut and Mike in North Jersey and cover a win for Brooks Koepka, but certainly not a day that he's going to be proud of. I mean, it was just one of the most bizarre finishes to a tournament you will ever see. I've never seen anything crazier than that. Mike will break it all down to start us off. John will break it down too. But the summary is basically he had a 7-stroke lead on the on the last day of competition, and over the course of 3 holes, he gave up almost the whole lead. So it's pretty crazy. Dustin Johnson was playing very well until those final two holes, and it wasn't quite enough for him. But Koepka wins it. Other than that, he had a really dominant weekend, and all, you know, you still got to give him credit for winning the tournament. But it was something else. So let's get started. I don't want to waste any more time. I do want to apologize to our crew for starting so late. I came into the thing late. And then I got a phone call in the middle of starting the show the first time. There are days where I miss doing the show live. Today is a day I'm very glad we're not doing the show live, because that was an epic fail starting it us off. But we are here and ready to go. So let's bring in our crew to the program, and we'll start with John in Connecticut. John, good to have you back, and it's cool to hear that you're doing golf yourself with a league. How's it going tonight?
Yeah, doing well, Dave. Thanks for having us back on. Yeah, I do a spring/summer league. It's a good thing to, I guess, kind of force myself to play, because you play once a week on Wednesday nights. And then even if I don't get to go on the weekends, I know I have the league match. And it's kind of fun. It's a little, you know, you're not playing for, like, money or anything, but it's just a little thing to kind of get the competitive juices flowing. So it's a good thing to be involved in, and excited to be here to discuss the PGA, which – I'm sure we'll have our feelings on, what our overall thought is about it moving to May, which is interesting. But it's quite an interesting time in the world of golf, and it was a fun tournament to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Now let's bring in our next panelist, and that is Mike in North Jersey. Good to have you back with us, Mike. How's it going tonight?
Oh, it's good to be back, Dave. Nice to talk golf with you and John again. Believe this would be our first May show. I don't think we ever did a Players Championship recap in the years that we've been doing this. So first time in May, it's good. You know, this particular day, I always find it to be like a transitional type of day, because, you know, it's the first time in a long time that we don't have either the NHL or the NBA to watch on a particular night. You know, the playoffs start off, and you know, I do like the NBA. I do like basketball in general, but I'm just such a big hockey guy that I'm into that. But then as the hockey thins out, I can start getting the basketball a little bit. But here we are, May 22nd, no NHL or NBA to watch. And yeah, kind of really marks the point where we turn the page to baseball. So a sort of a bittersweet night, but it'll be nice to talk golf with you guys.
It's a good night to do. Yeah, it winds up being a very open date for all three of us, because it's a surprise that we don't have anything right now. I mean, Boston just crushed Carolina. We can talk about a little bit of that later, Mike. I couldn't believe how non-competitive that series was. And then the Dubs put away Portland on Monday, which, I think makes sense, and even though the Blazers did everything they could to try to win any of those games. So it's it is indeed an unusual spot. Like, this is definitely the first of its kind in quite a while, like over a month and a half. So it's a very interesting stuff. PGA in May, John teased that. It's a very interesting spot. Why don't we start, though, with the actual tournament itself? And this would have been a 30-minute show if it wasn't for just the wackiest back nine I've ever seen in my life. I mean, Brooks Koepka was destroying the entire field. There was no juice. Nobody was even close. Nobody was even inside. There was a point where I don't even think people were barely over par besides Brooks Koepka on Saturday. So the fact that we have this much juice is really crazy. And that really just shows you how tough golf is. And so that's where I'll start. Let's go back to Mike for a second, and let's get the rundown of what happened on that back nine. It certainly was crazy the way that Brooks Koepka won, although it didn't feel like a win after that afternoon.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, Dave. I mean, he didn't blow the tournament. This didn't turn into Greg Norman at the 1996 Masters or Arnold Palmer at the 1967 U.S. Open, where he was in position to break the scoring record at the U.S. Open, and he had a 9-shot lead, and he blew it in nine holes. No, excuse me, a 7-shot lead, he blew it in nine holes, shooting a 40 on the back nine. Just never able to get himself out of that attack mentality. And of course, Palmer would only win one U.S. Open in his career, so I can't go that far with it. I mean, look, full disclosure, I did not see this final round live. A friend of mine offered me to take me out to a nice golf course and pay my greens fee, so had to take him up on that. But I was monitoring the situation closely on my phone during the round. After Koepka birdied 10, 10 being an extremely tough hole, the lead got, I think it was 6 at that time. You figure, well, this one's over. 8 holes to go, 6-shot lead. You know, the back nine is tough. You figure he's got this in the bag. And then I'm just seeing on now, I did watch the entire replay of the final round, at least for when Koepka got going Monday night on the CBS Sports Network. So I did see everything that happened. But then on Sunday, I'm just looking at my phone and it's like, okay, it's 5, it's 4, it's 3, and it's one shot. But luckily for Brooks Koepka, DJ became DJ the second it got to one shot. I mean, you got to give him a lot of credit for Dustin Johnson, that is, for being able to birdie 15 four consecutive days. Now, I've actually been to Bethpage Black. I've seen the course in person. I was there at the 2012 Barclays. 15 is just such a difficult hole. It's so uphill. You can't run a ball up at all to the green just because it's short of it. It's surrounded by bunkers and rough. So just this little sliver of fairway. So for him to birdie 15 and get within one shot, you're like, oh, here we go. But he then makes a terrible miscalculation on 16. Now, he can say all he wants about how he thinks he made the right choice. He obviously didn't make the right choice. You got a pin over on the left side, and he basically tries to hit a draw 4-iron into that. It goes way over the green, and he bogeys that. And then really, he just fell apart after that. He's long on 17 in the rough. He bogeys. And 18, he was very lucky to par because he just hit first shot into the rough and the second shot long and way left of the green. So a fortunate par there. And it just the bogey to only have that very, very short period where Koepka had to think about, oh, shit, I might lose this. I think that helped him out because he was very aware of what was going on. He said after his round, he knew right away that DJ had bogeyed 16 and then he had a little breathing room. But I do think we need to give him a lot of credit here. Look, he was 12 under par through 2 days on a very, very, very tough golf course. He's one of only, I think, 4 or 5 men to now shoot 63s. Multiple times in major championships. just to have that 7-stroke lead, look, he did need to use some of that collateral he built up, but he earned it. He was so far ahead after three rounds, he could afford to have a 4-hole hiccup. And now this is Koepka's 4th major win overall, his 4th major win in his last 8 major starts, which is mind-boggling. But even more impressive than that, he's now won 3 of the last 5 majors. And let's face it, he's one good swing away on the 12th hole in the final round at Augusta from having won 4 of the last 5 majors and 3 in a row. So this has become an all-time dominant stretch of golf. And we'll see what the future holds. Right now, look, we know that McIlroy got the 4 at 25 and stalled out. And, well, I mean, Spieth, it still hasn't been 2 years since he last won a major, so can't close the door on him. But sometimes these can dry up quickly. But the way it looks right now, Koepka could get to 8, 9, maybe even 10 majors the way he's playing right now. This is an all-time dominant stretch that he's going through right now. And to be able to right the ship a little bit on 15, a tough driving hole, to put it down the fairway, again at 16, just to be able to, steady himself in that possible moment of doubt, I think speaks to his character and his toughness under pressure and why he's been able to be so good in these majors. So another major win for Brooks Koepka, and the guy is really starting to put a stamp on this era as his own in the world of golf.
And it really sneaks up on you, because I think he probably has I don't know about you guys, but it seems like he has the fraction of the flair. The charisma of, say, guys like Phil Mickelson, or guys like Tiger, or guys like even more modern players, for example, I don't like him, but Bubba Watson. I mean, obviously he's a guy that moves a needle. People watch him because he always has personality involved with these rounds. Brooks is a little bit more focused. He's more of a clinical type of a golfer, and maybe that's one of the reasons why I don't this is all just kind of snuck up on me. But he's definitely done a lot. Like, he won this thing in back-to-back years. I mean, that alone is a really big achievement. So, Mike, you're right. He's really on a roll. Let's go back to John and get your thoughts on that final round. And you know, I think between the three of us, you might have been the only one that saw it in real time, because I saw all of that on replay when I got home from my trip. And just watching it on replay, I was like, oh, this is unbelievable. I couldn't stop. I just kept watching it. But you watching that live, John, what was that like?
Yeah, I did watch it in real time. I can only imagine what it was like for you guys, like kind of watching it on tape delay. And if you didn't know the result ahead of time, and just after each bogey, and just like, oh shit, what's going on here? Oh my God, he bogeyed again. And then when DJ makes the birdie to get within one shot, you're like, oh my, is he really going to blow this lead? And then, like Mike said, DJ just had a horrible decision on 16 and ended up making bogey, and that just kind of took all the wind out of his sails. But still, I mean, if you had told Dustin Johnson before the week, all right, I'll give you all 4 rounds in the 60s under par, all 4 days, and I'll give you 6 under for a total, he would have taken that, and 99 times out of 100, he's going to win the tournament. Because, I mean, this was just an incredibly difficult course, especially on Sunday afternoon with all those winds. I can only imagine what the scores would have been if this was a U.S. Open setup. I mean, the PGA is usually pretty timid and mild with some of the pin positions and the way they set up the course. It was still, you only had 6 players finish under par for the week. So, Koepka, he dominated the first 2 rounds, and then he did what he had to do on the weekend, which is basically just don't fall apart, play solid golf. He did that the stretch of bogeys, the 4 holes, as you guys mentioned, that brought it down to a 1-shot margin, but he was able to keep his composure, hit the shots he needed to hit, and claim the victory. And it would have been interesting to see what would have happened if DJ had just parred those holes and finished at 8 under, if Brooks would have been able to finish that with just the 1-shot lead. I don't know. We'll never know what would have happened. But, I was kind of rooting for that scenario just to kind of see it play out. Because once DJ bogeyed 16 and 17, I mean, you basically knew it was over. Unless something really crazy happened, which could happen on that course. I mean, you have some big, some guys made a bunch of big numbers, but he was able to hold his composure and get the win. And really, that, I mean, that's the key to his game. Is like it's kind of like what we mentioned about Tiger at the Masters. Like, even if through all of what Tiger's been through with his swing and his back and all the injuries and what else, the one thing he's always had an edge on for guys on the tour is his mental approach to the game and how he thinks about the game. And you can kind of see a similar thing with Koepka. Like, he's not intimidated by anything. He's mentally strong, and in addition to his green being unbelievable, I mean, he drives it long, he's got incredible touch around the greens, and he's a clutch putter. I mean, other than that, I mean, there's really, you know, no holes in his game, but it's just his mental makeup, I think, is so strong that a lot of these guys, they're out of it by the first hole on Thursday because they just can't handle the pressure of the moment. I mean, there's no moment that's too big for Koepka, and I mean, really seen that because he's got four wins in majors, and then he only has one other win on the PGA Tour. I believe it was the Phoenix Open a couple of years ago. I think either 2015 or 2016, he got his first win. But other than that, all his four of his wins are majors. So he shows up for the big events. It's not to say that he doesn't play good in other regular tour stuff. I mean, he finished second at the Byron Nelson the week before the PGA. But it's just kind of interesting how all of his, basically 80% of his wins are majors. And I agree with what Mike said. I mean, his career kind of did start a little bit late compared to some of these guys. I think he's 28 or 29. I mean, he played the Challenge Tour in Europe to get his card. He didn't go through Q school. So he wanted to gain experience and, you know, learn how to play tournament golf. And, you know, he worked his way up and qualified for the PGA Tour. It took him a little while. So he's older compared to some of, you know, the younger players. But you really could see a situation where he could maybe get to eight or nine majors, and I mean, that would be a hell of a career. I mean, the way he's going now, I mean, if he wins every four out of eight, I mean, he'll be right up there with some of the all-time greats. So we're not going to go there just yet because obviously, you know, four majors is great. It's not an all-time great just yet. He needs to get some more, but the way he's been playing, certainly on the way, and you know, just very, very impressive to watch him dominate that course over the first 2 days, and then the mental fortitude he had to finish it off is, you could see he was slipping a little bit there, especially on the 14th hole, that par three. You can kind of see that was the first time he kind of looked a little rattled, but after that he held his composure and got the job done.
Yeah, I got it. And I think Mike is right. I mean, even though he played so terribly for a lot of those holes, finishing the deal was still a very big, big thing. I mean, just not giving up the lead in all outright took a tremendous, that's tough to do. And he did it. And I do also want to give a nod to what he was doing the first three rounds. I mean, he really was dominant, and it was actually a lot of fun to watch. Like, he was really hitting some great shots, making some big putts. It was, you know, what I was able to see over the first 3 days of that tournament was very good. Like, I think he did a really good job. I think the only shame of it is that since he was so good, nobody else is anywhere near him, so there was nothing else to watch. Everybody just waiting for him to make his shots. So, John, I will stay with you for a second because I wanted to get your thoughts about him, the personality. He's not Arnold Palmer, right? Like, he's not going to captivate an audience with the way he plays or his reactions after shots, but he definitely is very good. So I wanted to get your feeling about what he is as a persona.
I don't know. I think he's opened up a little bit more to the media and just in general since he's kind of come on the scene as, you know, compared to 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, I don't know. I don't think it's like a drawback to his career or his popularity. I mean, people will say, oh my God, like, you know, no one's going to turn into the TV to watch Brooks Koepka, but it's the same thing that we've always said. Like, there's golf fans and then there's Tiger fans. And that's kind of how I look at this. Like, any golf fan enjoys watching Brooks Koepka play. Like, if you say, oh, I mean, I don't think he's a, you know, personable guy, or he doesn't have a great personality or a flair. Like, okay, you must be just a Tiger Woods fan. That's my response to that. I mean, I think he's, you know, he's not the most charismatic guy to use your word from earlier, but I mean, if you enjoy watching golf, I mean, you enjoy watching Brooks Koepka play. I mean, how could you not? I mean, he's just, all levels of his game, like I said, are just tremendous. And You know, for someone who plays golf, like you really enjoy watching him play and dominate a course like Bethpage Black. So I really don't see an issue with that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think it's fine. Like I said, he's opened up more with the media too, in terms of, like, you know, questions and some of the reactions, you know, on the course. So I don't see it as that big of a deal.
Well, I think what helps him is that the game itself is actually very entertaining. Like, he can do, as you mentioned, he's really good at many different facets of the game. And that much I do enjoy. And the fact that he's opening up definitely helps him, I believe, for his marketability. So very well said, John. Let's go to Mike and let's get your thoughts on Koepka the person. You know, we did a little bit of this with Patrick Reed last year. So this study of Brooks Koepka the man would be a fun study as well. So, Mike, let's get your thoughts.
Well, he's someone who definitely doesn't get too high and doesn't get too low. We don't see very much emotion from him on the golf course. But I completely agree with what John said. Like, anyone that I've heard call up Mike Francesa or Chris Russo in the last week that doesn't like Koepka is basically a Tiger Woods only fan. Now, let's be honest about Tiger Woods. We know at this point that Tiger Woods, it's because he's had this legendary career and he's like this older legend, and there's a draw to that. But early on in Tiger Woods' career, yeah, he would fist pump and do stuff like that. But has Tiger Woods ever given an answer in like a media session or anything like that that didn't sound like it was written by a public relations firm, or just wasn't just something completely ridiculous or athlete speak? And then when you see him walking through the crowd, he doesn't high five anyone. At least Koepka will high five the kids when he goes by. So I really don't buy this. Oh, I can't get into this. The guy's won 3 of the last 5 majors. If you're not tuning in to see someone doing that, you don't really like golf. It's just that simple. But John's definitely right, though. He has opened up, and he's told a couple of really, really funny stories, I thought, in like the last couple months. He mentioned that he can't stand like players who like play really slow. So he says what he does, what he'll do is if he gets grouped with slow players, he'll like take a few bathroom breaks and he'll just like stand in the bathroom and won't do anything. And he'll walk slowly. And it's just so that he does it intentionally, so they get put on the clock and have to speed up. So I just thought that was hilarious. Like, what a great way to deal with slow players.
Yeah.
And then his posting a picture of Brandel Chambly on his Twitter account with a clown nose on his face.
Really?
I thought that was pretty funny.
Okay, he's putting some points with me, Mike. This is very good. I'm enjoying this.
And what was the other thing he was doing recently? Oh, yeah, just the way he described his mindset in major championship. He goes, look, I know that I'm good enough to beat most of these guys. Then in a major championship, the setup's going to take out half of them. And the other half, like, then another third of them are going to be afraid to win. So that means I only need to beat, like, 20, 30 players. So they're easier to win, which is a page out of Jack Nicklaus's book. It very much straddles that line between confident and cocky, but I like that. The guy knows he's good. He knows he has the mindset to win these, and he's not afraid to say it. So, look, he's not the most demonstrative guy. He's not Phil Mickelson. He's not Arnold Palmer. But I do think he gives you a little bit of insight to what he's thinking. So he's not the most dull guy in the world. I do think there are some likable things about him.
That's a very nice look inside his personality, Mike. I really appreciate these anecdotes. Certainly, I can get behind the slow play scenario. I can't stand people who play slow. I would troll them as well if I had that kind of cachet that I could do that. So that is good stuff. So now let's go look at the rest of the field, and there's not much of a rest of the field to even talk about. I mean, the only competitor really the entire tournament was Dustin Johnson, and that was really only on that final day. The rest of the tournament, I mean, from the very beginning, it was kind of interesting because Koepka was up so, had his round so early, and he was so dominant in the first round that he was already up by five. He had like a minus five in the first, is it five? I think it was five under on the first day. So he was at a, he had a big lead from the moment most people got up in the morning. And it was kind of a sight to see, really. So this will be a short segment in essence. I mean, surprises and disappointments, I guess we can get into that. But honestly, everybody played about the same. Everybody was pretty far back. So we'll do the rest of the field now. And I think we'll start with John and get your thoughts on what you saw. I mean, yeah, so plenty of disappointments. Tiger didn't even make the cut. Rory wasn't so great. They kept cutting to Jordan Spieth. I don't know why, because he was really not doing much, you know, in the last couple of rounds. But anyway, let's get your thoughts on whatever what you saw from the rest of the field.
Well, this was the first encouraging performance from Spieth in a while. I mean, he's really been struggling, and he ends up finishing in a tie for third. If you look at his stats,
he tied for third?
Unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah, he tied for third, two under.
That's pretty good.
He had an unbelievable week putting. So I take this with a little grain of salt because a hot week putting is kind of like a, you know, a guy that's hitting, you know, a baseball player that just is just finding all the gaps and, you know, and it's just not going to, over time, it's going to average out. So I want to see a couple more tournaments from him, a couple more good tournaments before I finally can say, all right, maybe Spieth's a contender here for the majors. But it was definitely a sign in the right direction for him. Patrick Cantlay is always he's a very consistent player. I don't know if he has what it takes to win these kind of events just yet. I know he did make that charge at the Masters and had the lead briefly, but he's very consistent. And, you know, for just like fantasy fan duel purposes, I mean, you could take him almost every time with confidence that he's going to be around in the top 10 or top 15. Here he finished tied for third, another consistent week, and really didn't see much of him, and he finished tied for third. I'll mention McIlroy. That's just like the typical Rory McIlroy performance. Just horrible for most of the week. Did just enough on Friday to make the cut, and then backdoors a top 10 with a one-under round on Sunday. I mean, that's just kind of – that's his game at the moment. You know, never threatened, but just good enough to kind of sneak into the top 10. Same thing with Kuchar. That's like a typical top 10 for him in a major. Just sneaks in the back door with a minus one. That's pretty much – all I wanted to talk about in the top 10. Well, how about our guy? I'm going to try to pronounce his name once. Jazz Janawananan from Thailand. So here on known as Jazz, I will not say his last name again. What a tremendous job by him.
Yeah.
For a while there, he was like third place, second place. He kind of had a rough back nine. A lot of these guys did. But for someone who mostly plays on the Asian tours to come to Bethpage and put up a performance like that, I mean, it's very encouraging for someone like him. So great job out of him. And he, you know, I just don't want to sound like a MAGA person right now, but he spoke great English when they, I did not expect that when they interviewed him. So that was good to see too. And the fans seemed to embrace him. So that was a good job out of Jazz, and maybe we'll see more of him. I guess if you want to get into our surprises and disappointments at the moment, I don't know. You know, Tiger, You see what happens when two things. This isn't like Augusta where if you miss the fairway, you can make miraculous pars and birdies. If you miss the fairway here at Bethpage Black, you're not doing anything. And he missed way too many fairways this week. So I don't know what his sycophant fans expected if he was going to miss the fairway, that he was going to make all these birdies and dominate the tournament. No, like he struggled with the driver. He didn't putt very well. It was just an off week. And that also leads me to my next point. Why the hell is a 43-year-old man taking a month off on a competitive golf? Like, he can't take a month off in between these tournaments. He'll probably play Memorial before the U.S. Open, so he'll probably play next week. But in my opinion, I think that was a huge mistake for him not to play a competitive tournament before this PGA Championship, in my opinion. Let me see who else missed the cut here. I mean, no real huge surprises. I'm just going through a list. Nothing that jumps out at me. Maybe Mike will have somebody. But I will say another surprise. How about Rich Beam shooting 269s? Of course, they're surrounded by rounds of 82 and 75. But, hey, for a guy who literally plays one tournament, I think this is the only tournament he plays all year because he's a past champion of the PGA. I don't know. Maybe he plays I don't think he's old enough for the Champions Tour. Maybe he plays mini tours. I have no idea. But he plays the PGA every year, and he shot 269s on Bethpage Black, and he shot a 69 on Sunday in those conditions. So good job, Rich Beem. And we mentioned Rich. I'll say, you know, bringing up that name, Rich Beem, that just kind of shows you the competition that Tiger was winning majors against in the early 2000s, against guys like when Rich Beem was beating him. Compared to today, there's no comparison to the talent pool today of the top 30 to 50 golfers compared to back in the early 2000s. So that's kind of what I think of when I see Rich Beem.
Right. I do want to get I didn't give Spieth enough credit there. I had no idea that he was tied for third place. That's really good. You know, I did know that he was -3, but what I didn't realize is that being -3 at Bethpage Black after four rounds is actually pretty dang good. And so I just had no feel for how close he actually was. He's actually much closer than I realized. So yeah, no, I didn't realize all the and I know he's been struggling recently. So that bad job out of me. But John, I do want to ask you a follow up. Were you feeling for who was it? Varner the third, who teed off in the final group with Koepka, and then that was an odd pairing, but I guess it's just how it worked out. But then he had that one really bad hole, and he just blew up after that, like a triple bogey. And then the next hole, he hits it way into the thatch, and it took him like 10 minutes to find the ball, and they couldn't find it. I was feeling pretty bad for him, but were you surprised to see him that, you know, in that final grouping? And what was your thought on him going through that course?
It was just kind of out of nowhere on Saturday. That, like, again, like CBS is, you know, they're not any different than any other networks. Like, they don't show a lot of players, but all of a sudden, like, he birdies a couple holes on the back nine on Saturday, and due to the other results, he ends up in the final group. It's the way they do it is the first one in is always the last one out. So he was the first guy to post, I believe it was 5 under, mm-hmm. On Saturday. So he got put in the final group, and I mean, you knew he was going to struggle. I mean, right. I don't think he's never won a tour event, and he's just kind of an average tour player. And it was funny because he birdies the first hole and everyone's like, oh, watch out for Harold. And he ends up, 12 or 13 over after that. So I did kind of feel bad for him, but you know, I guess you could say it's a good learning experience for him, and maybe he'll use it to his advantage to maybe win a PGA event, PGA Tour event, mm-hmm. Later this year. But yeah, it's a tough spot for sure. And, you knew it was going to be a struggle for him.
Yeah, no, that's true. I didn't think he was going to keep playing like that on Sunday. It was not likely. I didn't think he was. I mean, once he did that with that the triple bogey, I was like, yeah, that's pretty much it. Like, and that was that. But it also set up a very interesting scenario because it also meant that Dustin Johnson, and I don't know where he finished on Saturday, but I guess if not for Varner, he could have been in that final group with Koepka instead, and that would have been an interesting head-to-head, but it could have played to his advantage, and we'll go to Mike to talk about the rest of the field. That could have played to Johnson's advantage because he had to first look at all these holes before he knew what Brooks Koepka was going to do with them, so we'll never really know, but it was very interesting to see, Johnson made a shot, and then Koepka makes a shot, and then Johnson makes another shot, and then Koepka takes another shot. It was a very interesting back and forth we were seeing down that final nine. So, all right, Mike, let's get your thoughts on the rest of the field, then the surprises, then the disappointments.
Well, I guess we'll start with the large feral cat. I wasn't too surprised that he missed the cut. He did have that one really nice stretch. It was on his second. It was on the front nine, but it was his second nine on Thursday. He birdied one and two, and then he eagled four. But other than that, he was pretty terrible. I mean, he's missing fairways all over the place. He was hitting short wedges over the green. His speed on the greens was absolutely horrific. And I agree with John. Why he didn't show up at Wells Fargo a couple weeks ago at Quail Hollow, which would have been a very good course to get yourself warmed up for to play Bethpage Black. Once he didn't show up there, it's like, well, what do you really expect? And of course, that that Mongo who bet, what was it, like $100,000 on him to win the Masters, of course, followed off and made another large bet on Tiger Woods to win the Grand Slam for this year. So of course, that money went up in flames, which is deservedly so.
Yeah.
So a little bit of karma exerting itself there. So not surprised to see Tiger Woods struggle. I'll give you a name that a guy that I thought was really well cut out for this course, and that was John Rahm. Now, we know John Rahm has some, like, anger issues. He gets too hot. I don't know if he actually has anger issues, but he lets himself get too emotional on the course, and his temper runs a little hot. But I thought with his ability to hit the driver, his length, he can be a little bit deft with the short game. I thought that he was a good fit for this course, but he missed the cut. So a bit disappointing there. Sergio Garcia missed the cut again. He has missed the cut in every major since he won the Masters a couple of years ago. So I know after that event, we kind of talked a little bit like, well, it's got one or two ways for Sergio, and it's gone the wrong way. So he's got to figure some stuff out, because I know he's going to want to be on the next Ryder Cup squad for Europe. So he's got to start figuring it out a little bit. Other surprises in this, well, John already touched on our friend Jazz Jano Wanatanamananada, whatever his name is. Yeah, the interesting thing I saw about him was he turned pro when he was 15 years old and was like a nobody. How do you turn pro? Like, didn't he show up for, like, something, said, I want to turn pro? Shouldn't the guy have been like, yeah, no, you can't do that. But they have relaxed rules about that. So he's been a pro since he was 15 years old. Don't know how that's possible, but it's what he did. So good showing for him. Other surprises. I guess we'll go over Adam Scott. This is the third straight major where, at least in the opening rounds, he's been pretty strong. But, I mean, Adam Scott is just such a bad putter. And his strategy this year is just to go between different, like, completely different putting techniques and hope that one works for the week. But he just misses so many just really short putts, and it just knocks the wind out of his sails. But big picture-wise, though, it did kind of look like he was starting to really fall off, but he seems to be ramping it back up. But I don't know if he's going to win anything ever again, because his putting is just horrific. John touched on this too. Rory McIlroy, a backdoor top 10. I mean, really. I will give him a little credit for managing to make the cut, because he was like four or five shots out of the cut line early on Friday. He got off to a horrific start. Let's see what it was exactly here. Okay, so he shoots 72 in round one, which wasn't good, but wasn't completely terrible. You're still in position there. But he starts off on the back nine. Listen to what he does. He goes double bogey, bogey, double. So he is five over after three. He birdies 13, but he then bogeys 15. So he's seven over par with 12 holes to play, but he manages to make the cut. Four birdies coming in, so good to see a little bit, but, you know, just I've gone over this before. If we said after that 2014 PGA Championship win that Rory McIlroy would be sitting here in May of 2019 and McIlroy would not have won another major, we all would have been shocked. So, well, I know he's got a Royal Portrush coming up, so his hometown, so we'll see. Any other big disappointments? I can't say it's much of a disappointment, but I did gamble on Lee Westwood for my FanDuel squad, you know, figuring Yeah, he's up there in age, but we know that he has some prodigious ball striking ability, but it did not work out for Mr. Westwood, and he missed the cut, so thus sinking my FanDuel squad in the process. So not a good showing from Lee. Phil Mickelson made the cut but didn't do anything. Not much of a surprise there. And just to clarify on Rich Beem, I did do a quick Wikipedia search for him. He will be 49 in August, so he's not yet eligible for the senior tour. And John was correct. He does not play any other tours. He does not. It's the only competitive round, competitive event he plays all year. He's making his living right now as a color commentator on the Sky Sports coverage of golf over there in the UK. So good job by him.
Does he live near? No, I guess he doesn't live near any. I guess the PGA is in different places every year. But does he live? Does he then live in the UK right now? Or would you know offhand?
I wouldn't know off the top of my head.
No. Okay, I didn't know either, so I'm just wondering. Okay, so let's, speaking of coverage, let's talk about the TV coverage, and we'll go back to John.
Yeah, it's a last hurrah for TNT. I can't say we're all disappointed about that. They just have that weird setup on Thursday and Fridays where they have, three different, sets of announcers. Like, you had Nance paired. I honestly didn't watch a ton of the coverage on Thursday and Friday. Mostly it was just trying to get a stream at work, and then may I watch like an hour when I was home after. But you had Brian Anderson and Trevor Immelman were like one set of announcers. And then you had it might have been Nance and Dottie Pepper, or it might have been Lundquist and Dottie Pepper were another one. And then Nance was on there. It's just really bizarre how they go about it. TNT, good riddance for next year. At least they didn't have Ernie Johnson wasn't there, and he's just not a good fit for this. I thought Brian Anderson did a pretty good job for the lead anchor for TNT. And Immelman is pretty good, too. He definitely has a future in broadcasting. His brother, Mark, is on CBS doing course reporting for some of the lower-tier events. So you can definitely see that family is they got the knack for it. Then as for CBS, I mean, it is what it is. We know what we're getting with them. We didn't have to do the Tiger ass kiss rankings this weekend, thank God, because he missed the cut. But Ian Baker Finch was absent. I guess there was a death in his family, so tough spot there. So he was not calling the golf. So I guess that kind of moved up all the spots of the rest of the announcers. Vern Lundquist, I think we all agree, is a little bit past his, what he should be doing. But, I mean, he sits in a tower and calls a couple shots. Good for him. But I can see why they took him off SEC football, because he definitely has lost his fastball. But, we can deal with him for a couple majors every year. In terms of digital coverage, they had the feature group online on Thursday and Fridays. You could watch the groups in the morning, which is good. But in terms of shot tracker, nothing near the Masters, which we had talked about. I don't think any tournament is going to be near what the Masters had. It was kind of similar to the PGA shot tracker, PGA Tour shot tracker, which is, it is what it is. At least it's something to follow your FanDuel team. And speaking of that, my FanDuel team also flamed out over the weekend, but I did finish fourth, which is, I'd rather be at Mike's scenario and just being blown out of the water than finish fourth after Ricky Fowler just completely derailed my chances on Sunday with a 77, so I will not be liking him for a while after that. But I digress. So yeah, there was no big complaints or grievances for the broadcast. I guess we say goodbye to TNT and hello to ESPN next year, right, for the PGA. So I guess maybe more Chris Berman in the mix for those last couple hours. God help us.
Hopefully sanity will prevail in that exchange between TNT and ESPN. All right, Mike, let's get your thoughts on the broadcast.
Quickly on Berman, I'm fully expecting that to happen, because remember how we were all happy that Fox Sports or Fox and Fox Sports 1 were going to be getting the U.S. Open And then that first year was just a complete fucking disaster with like the camera being too zoomed in so you couldn't see where the ball was landing in relation to the hole. I mean, that was just shockingly bad. So we've complained a lot about TNT over the years, rightfully so. So I think it would only be fitting if things follow the script of the past. If, you know, we're thinking, well, ESPN, there should be expanded coverage, but we go in and it's Chris Berman welcoming us to the broadcast. So fully expecting that to happen. It'll be funny for about 15 minutes and then we'll be sick of them. with TNT, I'm sorry. I mean, look, Ernie Johnson seems like a nice guy, but I thought the broadcast was markedly better with him not being there. It just, there were none of these like forced segues over to him where he just like awkwardly goes over something he doesn't know. It felt like because he's a big star over with TBS or TNT, I should say, not TBS. You feel like they would like force feed him a little bit and it would just screw up the flow of the broadcast. So no Ernie Johnson was definitely a positive. I agree with John. Trevor Immelman, he's pretty good at this. And I don't know, maybe if I would not be against if NBC finally comes to the senses and realizes that Azinger is terrible, maybe moving Immelman into that spot in a couple of years. Wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. Although we finally got the answer as to why Faldo is not part of this broadcast when the rest of the CBS crew is, because Nance was on with Mike Francesa to close out the Mike show on Friday. And Mike asked him, he's like, well, where's Faldo? And Nance said, because Faldo also has a deal with the Golf Channel, he can't be on the TNT broadcast. So I guess that's your reason. We won't be missing TNT. It's just this starting way too late. Although I was with John too. You know, I was stuck in work. I was watching a stream of the featured groups on mute, basically. So I did miss a lot of it. But you know, if you're gonna find a way to get out of work, the coverage should be starting earlier. I don't know why they wait till 1 o'clock to do that. But no more of that. And the mishmash of the CBS people and putting them in different roles. And they're usually with the CBS. So we won't miss them. I don't know if you guys have iPhones or something, but on my, I have a Google Pixel 3 with an Android operating system. And there was no shot tracker on my PGA championship app. And I did see something on Twitter where someone was saying that was also the case. So I don't know. Their app, frankly, is absolutely terrible when you consider what the Masters app has now. I mean, to not have at least, or maybe I'm just an idiot, to not have a shot tracker on it. You were still able to go on the PGA Tour app itself, and they had the shot tracker, but it was like a few minutes behind, much more behind than it would be normally for a PGA Tour event. So disappointing there. And the other thing, too, is with their streaming, with their online streaming, they need to get a little bit better. They have a couple featured groups, but that's it. They have commercials, which, look, they're not the Masters. They need commercials. I understand that, but give us some featured holes to watch or something too, just so that we don't have as much downtime, be a little bit better. So we'll see what a good riddance to TNT. Although one thing I should bring up, CBS, for whatever reason, was showing an interview with Dustin Johnson when Brooks Koepka was hitting his second shot on 18. And he was in a very, very, very thick lie for a second shot on 18, which could have been dicey. So bad job there. They should have been showing kept alive, and they should have maybe waited to air the Dustin Johnson interview. So, I mean, Koepka made a par, so it didn't end up being that big of a deal. But CBS was your typical CBS. no Ian Baker Finch, as John alluded to, so we didn't have to hear any overly positive commentary on players. And we'll see what ESPN has to offer next year.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think it's fair to expect the worst with ESPN, because we've seen them put up so much crap on TV with some of these events. So I'm with you there, Mike. And that'll wrap it up for the PGA Championship. So it's in May now. And it definitely brings different dynamics to the field and to the entire PGA Tour schedule. And this is a good opportunity to get some thoughts on what it's like to have it back in May after it's been in August for years and years. And John, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm saying it right now, maybe I'm a prisoner of the moment, but I liked it. I mean, I was a little concerned about, coverage or being taken away because of the NHL or NBA playoffs. And, you know, in my opinion, in a way, I really don't think that happened. I think, I think there was just one game. I think there's a game on Sunday, NHL game, the Sharks and Blues on Sunday, like actually during the actual tournament. I think the rest of the games were in prime time. So in terms of overlapping, it was just that one game. And I think the Blues won 5-0 anyway. So it wasn't a really competitive game. So I think it really worked out well. We'll see how I feel in August when, you know, it's just the FedEx Cup playoffs and there's literally nothing going on except for the dog days of baseball. But for now, I enjoyed the move to May. I like how you have this big event every month. And then the next couple tournaments work their way up to it. So I liked having that major in between the Masters and the U.S. Open. So for now, I'm for it. We'll see how I feel in August. And before you ask Mike, let me just pitch this idea to you guys, this question. So the PGA Championship next year is in Harding Park, which is in San Francisco. So will CBS follow the lead of what Fox has done recently when the tournament is on the West Coast and do primetime coverage? I'm almost positive that Fox is going to do that again this year for Pebble Beach next month. So the final round will be like 6-10 on a Sunday night for the East Coast, which I love. Do you think CBS will do the same thing? I've had my doubts about this. I think they're kind of an old school. I don't know if they'll do this. I mean, they did move it up for the Masters, but that was just weather related. But I do think they're going to move to primetime coverage for CBS and like kick off 60 Minutes and those other shows that they have on Sunday night. I was thinking about that. I'd be interested to hear what you guys think about that.
Well, they normally would do that sort of thing on the Saturday round, I think. I don't remember what they do on Sunday. So, no, I don't know. I guess I don't know. Let's go to Mike. Let's see what you think about that.
That's an interesting one. I do know that ESPN, at least according to Gary Williams, and he was on with Dog during the week, he was saying that ESPN absolutely plans on showing it in prime time. And what they're going to do is they'll roll it into like a 9:00 West Coast NBA conference finals game. So we're definitely going to see it with ESPN. CBS, they're going to be reluctant to put 60 Minutes out of the way. I just think that those are a little bit too, that's like too established of a show for them to do that. You get a million things on Twitter, where's 60 Minutes? Yeah. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. Maybe they'll do it Saturday, but they won't do it Sunday. I don't know. I'm kind of torn on that a little bit.
Yeah, I was thinking that if they were going to do it, they'd do it Saturday night. That seems a little more flexible. So, very good. So, Mike, let's get your thoughts on the PGA Championship in May.
Yeah, I'm with John. There was definitely, at least this is how I felt. I felt like there was a little bit extra juice here. I mean, let's be honest. The PGA Championship is, if you had to rank the majors 1-4, it's going to come in fourth every time. Each of the other ones, I think you can make an argument that they're the best major of the group. No one's going to make that argument at the PGA Championship. Now, that being said, it is still so far ahead of the next best tournament after it. It's much closer to the other three tournaments than it would be to like a Players' Championship or a WGC. So still an elite event, but putting this up in, bringing this up to May, making it the second major on the heels of Augusta, yeah, it felt like there was a little extra juice. Maybe Bethpage Black had a little bit to do with that too. I will say this because John talked about it earlier with how this. I think the PGA, ever since that 2015 event at Whistling Straits, where Jason Day was like, what, 20 under par, where it was just, Whistling Straits is a tough course, and it was just set up so easily. And they made a joke out of it. Ever since then, I think they've kind of gotten the mentality, look, if we're on a tough track, we're going to set it up a little bit more difficult than what we've been doing because we don't want to see that. We don't want it to be the U.S. Open, but we don't want to see 20 under par. Now, Belle Reve, we saw low scores, but I think that was more a product of the course that they had in front of them and the particular conditions that were going to be offered. So not much they could have done there without really tricking it out. But, you know, I like what I'm seeing with, you know, tough venues like Baltusrol, like Quail Hollow, like Bethpage Black, setting it up a little bit more tough. So I do like the move to May right now, but I also agree with John's other point. I'm nearly positive that August is going to roll around and we're going to be like, well, you know what? It'd be pretty nice to have the PGA Championship this week. One side effect of this, though, it's made the tournaments like between that were ordinarily between the Masters and the U.S. Open feel really, really pointless. Like at Quail Hollow, I just thought there was no juice, and there's usually some juice for that event. You know, Harbor Town always has its thing the week after. It's kind of like that that relaxed vibe. You just tune in to, you know, relax a little bit. The team event in Louisiana, that one almost has to go. It's just, it's getting such a bad field. But that's one possible side effect is you're just kind of waiting for the majors, but definitely a little bit more juice in the PGA with the move to May, I thought.
All right. Yeah. So in summary, a positive response from our golf crew regarding the move to May. And you're right, though, Mike. We're gonna have a better evaluation of this once we roll through August and we see no major golf on the horizon. That'll be very interesting to experience once we get there. So, you know, and by then it'll be pretty warm. I don't know what the weather's like where you guys are right now, but it has been pretty much colder than usual throughout the beginning of this year. Definitely, that's the case here in LA. So, let's now look at the road ahead. And speaking of the tournaments that now are pointless, Mike, let's get your look at the upcoming schedule for the tour.
Sure. Well, we have the Colonial this week, or now it's called the Charles Schwab Challenge or something. But it's good that Colonial had been a stop since the 1940s. And a couple of years ago, it was in some trouble. They thought it might not make it to this new condensed schedule, but Charles Schwab stepped in. So they seem to be in a pretty good place with a stable and a large sponsor. So good for them. You do have a pretty good field this week. John Rahm's playing, Francesco Molinari is playing, Justin Rose is playing, Jordan Spieth is playing, and Ricky Fowler is playing. So pretty good field. Be worth tuning into on the weekend. See who comes out on top there. 2 weeks, we have the Memorial. Obviously, it's Jack Nicklaus's tournament. We don't know for sure, but I'd expect that Tiger Woods would be playing in that event as his tune-up for the Masters. He's won it, I think, three or four times. Rory McIlroy be in the mix, and it's just Muirfield Village, just an outstanding course. So definitely tune in for that one in a couple weeks. Absolutely worth it just to see the course. A little bit of a Augusta National vibe. You definitely feel like that's what Jack Nicklaus was trying to go with at Muirfield Village. And then the week before, we'll have the Canadian Open. I don't know how much juice will be at that event. It won't be at the usual stop of Glen Abbey. It'll be at, I think it's Hamilton Golf and Country Club. So different course there. Might tune in briefly to see if the course is any good. If it is, maybe I'll watch for a bit. But I don't know. We're we're only a few weeks away from the start of the U.S. Open. So, you know, Pebble Beach in the mix, being able to see that course without without having to see celebrities pack it up all over the place. That'll be fun. So we have a good event coming up in a couple weeks, but we're already into U.S. Open countdown mode.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. I mean, it's been a while since we've had the U.S. Open up there, and it just, it's so beautiful. And, you know, if you've ever been there in person, and I have a couple times, it, you know, it never doesn't take your breath away. It always takes your breath away when you're there. It'll be good. So, you know, we could preview that a little bit. John, I'll give it to you for some other thoughts about the upcoming schedule, including the U.S. Open to come.
Yeah, not much else to say about the schedule. Mike broke it down there pretty good. Yeah, like the Colonial has a decent field. The Memorial should have even a better field, and that course is gorgeous. And, you know, doesn't have a major feel to the event, but has a big, you know, there's going to be juice there watching that tournament for sure. And then I have no idea what to expect out of the Canadian Open. Usually that spot was reserved for the FedEx St. Jude event in Memphis. That's going to be a World Golf Championship event later this summer in July, which is crazy, Memphis in July. But in any event, it was usually a bad field for that tournament. So who knows if the Canadian Open will suffer the same fate. What they do have going for them is the RBC connection, and a lot of the golfers are sponsored by RBC. So they might have a better field than the Memphis St. Jude event had. I'll talk about the U.S. Open in a second, but after the U.S. Open, the Travelers Championship, of course, here in Connecticut is being played. And I looked at the stretch of tournament after the Travelers Championship, and the Travelers Championship is the premier event after the U.S. Open now, because they have these two new events in the Midwest in Detroit and Minnesota, brand new tournaments. So who the hell knows what kind of like incentives or prize money or whatever, or like, you know, sponsors that, you know, how they're taking care of the golfers. So I have no idea about that. And then the John Deere Classic, which is never a good field before the Open Championship. So the Travelers Championship is going to have a great field this year for that reason, and I'm very excited about that. But anyway, back to the U.S. Open. Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun because, you know, usually see Pebble Beach in February where it's, you know, it's cold and rainy, and it's just, I mean, it's a nice course to watch, but I mean, it's not a great event in February, but now hopefully you're going to see it play hard and fast, and it's going to be a U.S. Open setup. And it's like Nick Faldo said on Sunday, the way to play at Pebble Beach is to hit it long and hit a fade. Well, who on the PGA Tour hits it long and straight and with a fade? I think he just won 4 out of the last 8 majors. So Brooks Koepka will be one of the favorites again, as well as Dustin Johnson, because he hits it long and straight and has a fade. So it'll be set up perfectly for both of them. But and like I said before, I love the primetime golf. You know, Fox is going to have it from 6 to 10 on Sunday night. Hopefully it's not a game 7 for the NBA Finals. I saw the schedule.
Is that really
for the NBA Finals? Really? And it could, yeah, Game 7, it would be the night of the U.S. Open. And if I'm choosing, I will definitely choose the U.S. Open over Game 7 of the Finals. I'm sure I'd pop it up on a stream on, like, an iPad or something, but I would not be actually watching it. I don't think we'll have that problem because the Warriors are going to win in 5 games anyway, whoever they play. But, I mean, tell me I'm wrong, Dave. I mean, the Bucks,
I don't know.
Raptors,
I kind of feel in the Buck,
the
but
Warriors.
You know what? I mean, it's a very solid. It's a solid prediction, though. I mean, it's yeah.
Yeah, I just don't see it. Whatever, but
it would be tough. Tough to actually see it, but I could give him a chance. I agree with you in the end.
Yeah,
yeah, that's true.
Okay, but yeah, I can't wait for the primetime finish. I mean, the last time we had the primetime golf was Chambers Bay, and we all remember that epic finish between Jordan Spieth and Dustin Johnson. So I expect a similar scenario at Pebble Beach, and it'll seeing the scenery and the primetime finish will be good enough to, you know, get us through Joe Buck and Paul Azinger for the last couple hours.
It can be its own hilarity. Now, we're going to I'm going to sort out my opinion on that NBA finals. I'll have a prediction next week for sure, but I do like the Bucks' chances more than I would like anybody else, cuz I think they've got the length, and it could be a much more competitive series than a lot of people think. So that'll be fun to watch, maybe. Or maybe I'm just lost and they'll just defend Giannis and they'll win in five, like John said. So who knows? Mike, I can give you a chance to predict that later. But first, let's get your let's get some additional thoughts in the U.S. Open. Any other thoughts you want to add?
Sure. One thing I would note about Pebble Beach is that, look, it's a great course, but you do have a tendency sometimes to get some quirky winners there. Like, you look at the last three U.S. Opens there. Obviously, we have Tiger Woods in 2000. All right, best player wins. Graham McDowell won in 2010. Now, granted, Graham McDowell for a couple of years played really, really, really good golf. I mean, he almost won the U.S. Open a couple of years later, too, at the Olympic Club. And then in 1994, a 40-something-year-old Tom Kite won the U.S. Open. So I think just because, you know, it's not a very long course, because it's going to play very tight, and because it'll likely take driver out of your hands a number of times, at least that's what I think the setup will do. I mean, there's certain holes. Like, one, you're never going to hit driver. Let's see, one, two, three, you're never going to hit driver. It's a lot of holes are just, they're not drivers. So you could get like an unexpected winner there. It wouldn't shock me, but obviously Koepka has to be the favorite. You got to put Dustin Johnson right behind him. Of course, Dustin Johnson had a great chance to win in 2010, but he was very green at the time and he blew up. So, it should be a great event. I guess one other thing I'll address is some future PGA championship sites, because I think I brought this up the last time we did a PGA recap too, but 2022 PGA championship will be at Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey. So, be a good site for a board meetup there, won't it?
What's left of it, Mike? I mean, Seriously, how much of a board is there going to be by 2022? I mean,
I'd like to know when they made the decision to bring the PGA Championship to that course. Was it before 2016 or was it after 2016? I would hope it would be before 2016, because, you know, like, if he's still president, then it's just going to be a complete shit show.
Yeah.
Even if he's not president, it's still going to be a shit show. But If he's still president, it's going to be horrible having the PGA Championship at that course. For no matter where, if you like him, hate him, it's just going to, the course and him is going to outshine the tournament, and it's going to be awful.
Can't argue with that. I mean,
yeah, no, you're 100% right about that. I mean, I'm 99.9% sure, because they do this stuff like, for example, they already know where the 2031 PGA Championships is going to be. So I'm nearly positive it was many years before he became president or even considered running. So,
I mean, couldn't they change that and make an executive decision and you know, drop it, you know, at the last second?
If they do at this point, you know, the entire MAGA crowd is just going to absolutely lose their fucking minds, you know, considering they're harassing families for sitting down during the national anthem. What will they do if they take a PGA championship away from a Trump course?
Oh, yeah, you went for it there. That. Oh, my God. good point, Mike. Good point. Jeez. All right. Well, I guess we'll leave it at that. And the thing about golf is that you're right. That's actually going to be that's a bigger factor when it comes to golf than other sports. In other sports, maybe you want to be a little more neutral about that sort of thing. But here, there will be a clear affiliation involved with that kind of a course. So they pretty much have to go through with it. So you just got to, for their sake, you got to hope that maybe conditions politically will change by that point in time. A lot can happen in 3 years. Let's like the Earth could die in 3 years. But no, I don't want to go that far. But you know what I mean. So very good. I love this comment though. That's pretty funny. I guess that's it for coverage tonight. But we do have a lot of time, so we can do some minutiae, potpourri, whatever you want to do. Let's. Let's get to some other things that you had on your mind, and we'll start with John. Any other potpourri you had? It doesn't even have to be about golf.
I don't know. Well, at least we're gonna get one good NBA series. This Raptors Bucks series seems pretty good. I hypothetically wagered that the Bucks were gonna win last night. I was just going by the trend, like they were the best team in NBA history coming off a loss, and they completely lay an egg in Toronto last night. And what the hell is up with Drake on the sideline, like
that? Yeah,
grabbing the coach and like patting him on the back like during the game. Like, bro, get off the court. Like, do you own the team now? Like, that's just ridiculous. I didn't understand that. So at least maybe that'll go seven games. I mean, the NBA playoffs have just been brutal. I mean, is there a more pointless season than the Western Conference and the NBA? Why even play for 8 months? Just put the Warriors in there every year. It's kind of sad how just the competitive balance. It's just nothing there. So
well,
at least the East will be. At least the East has some good juice for the last three games here. And then the NHL. I've been really enjoying the NHL playoffs. So we got the Blues and the Bruins for the Stanley Cup Finals. I will not make a prediction. I'll be rooting for the Blues. I think our friend Andy, who usually he's kind of turned a new leaf. He always used to wager against the Bruins. I think he's been partaking with the Bruins.
Really?
Yeah, exactly. You'll have to ask him about
it.
I think he kind of realized. Yeah, he kind of realized maybe it's a little better to. Okay, you're not really happy the team won, but at least you made some money instead of betting against them and just even being double pissed off that they won.
Yeah.
They just completely. I know Mike's the hockey expert here, so I'll let him break it down. But I mean, they just destroyed the Hurricanes four games in a row. I mean, you could clearly see the Hurricanes just could not match anything that they threw at them. And then when I was reading before all the series started about the Blues were like the worst team in hockey on January 1st, and they made that huge run to get to the playoffs. And, you know, I had thought they were going to win their first series, but after that, I really didn't expect much of them. So to get to this point, that's pretty cool. So I believe it's their first Stanley Cup in like 50 years, which is unbelievable. So great story for them. And I hope they continue it here in the finals. So, Mike can break down the X's and O's with each team. And if the Blues actually do have a chance, but I'll certainly be rooting for them. So, I've been enjoying that, and other than that, I mean, we're just kind of, we're going along with these sports, golf, football, and golf, basketball, and hockey, and before you know it, football season will be on around the corner. I mean, you see all these reports about the OTAs, and it's a little much to take for some of this, but it's exciting to see just a little snippets in the newspaper anyway, or online, just to read about. Like, for example, the Packers have their new coach and just interested to read the stories about the new offense and those kind of things. So just keeps you interested throughout the offseason.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, well, did you notice it was snowing at the Denver OTA? It's a weird week in weather. It is a weird week.
Yeah, I saw that. Like, the Midwest is getting just hammered with tornadoes. Mm-hmm. And then in the Rocky Mountains, they're getting just feet of snow. So it's crazy. And then here it's been beautiful. Although you asked about the weather earlier, Dave. For, I think, a month and a half, it was basically 45 degrees and raining basically every other day. And now it's finally starting to get a little warm. So definitely happy about that for golfing purposes anyway. Finally can get out there and play a little bit.
Yeah. We had a very strange situation in Southern California. And there was no indication we were going to get this today. But out of the blue, we ended up with maybe 3 hours of thunderstorm solid. Like, you heard a big boom, and then it was pounding rain for 2 hours solid. And the end result of that is that the Angels had to postpone their game tonight to tomorrow. I've never seen that. Like, I've never seen, like, just 2 hours of rain screw up a game that bad. And it really did. It really just came out of nowhere. It was just, you'll never see that in sports the rest of the year. It's just so crazy. So, yeah, let's go to Mike. Let's get back to the NHL. The Bruins series in the East Final, that is by far the least competitive series I have seen this, maybe in the decade, right? I mean, I've never seen a series where the other team was absolutely completely destroyed. They had they could not be in any part of that game. They were never in it from the very first puck drop. I was just blown away by how horrible the Hurricanes played. Maybe they just weren't that good and they were just getting off on good matchups. I don't know what the heck was going on. What was your takeaway on that? And then we can look ahead to the final as well. I would like St. Louis to win. They are a member of the Expansion Six, and I root for the Expansion Six too as a Kings fan. They're the last team without a title out of that Expansion Six. The Oakland Seals folded, so they can't be in the mix. But the other five, it's only St. Louis left, so I'm looking forward to that. Let's get your thoughts on the NHL.
Yeah, I was somewhat surprised too. Definitely didn't see a sweep. I did bet on the Bruins to win that series, but I didn't see a sweep coming. I think what this shows is that of course they call it the Atlantic. These division names and groupings are so stupid. But anyway, it just shows that the Atlantic was probably significantly stronger than the Metropolitan this year, the Columbus Blue Jackets notwithstanding. And of course they got thrown into the Atlantic group, beat Tampa Bay, and then, you know, Boston handled them, but they fought pretty hard during that series, to be fair to them. And the Leafs gave the Bruins a good showing too. I just think the difference was, look, the Carolina Hurricanes goaltending is Peter Mrazek and Curtis McElhinney. And where are you going with that in the end? Doesn't that have to sink you eventually? And Tuukka Rask, for many years, he's kind of been saddled with this label because he does have a Vezina trophy of being this great goaltender during the regular season, but not clutch. You know, that many Bruins fans still have fond memories of Tim Thomas, even though he is a I shouldn't get into it. We've already gotten into that stuff enough. But he's really shaken that label this year. I would say right now he's your clear leader for the Vezina Trophy entering into these finals. So the Bruins are just a tough team. They have this mix of skill and grit, which is kind of rare. And it is a trend in the NHL you're seeing now. That we saw the Blackhawks win with this speed game, and we saw the Penguins really win with a speed game, not so much worrying about necessarily having possession time in the zone, just trying to use their speed to get on-man rushes. We're starting to see like a reversion back to more of like the LA Kings style of winning, where they can grind you out a little bit, they can wear you down, so... it's typical of all sports, you know, a certain type of player, a certain style, it becomes the in thing. So players who have that skill become commodities, but as a result, they start to get paid a little bit more. And then other teams go, hey, wait a minute, maybe we can counter that by doing this. And then they can accumulate more skill because what the players that they want to get, they bring stuff to the table that maybe isn't necessarily being looked at as being as valuable as what like the speed players are doing. So it's just always an interesting back and forth to see how that works. But I, for one, I am so happy that the San Jose Sharks have lost because I cannot stand just seeing their fans having no fucking shame at all. Just not realizing that they were handed two huge gifts. And instead of just being like, you know what? We got a break, but we're not the only team that's ever gotten a break. Sorry, but it is what it is. All they've done is, well, you know, in that game, they missed a high stick on this guy, and there was a cross check here, and well, the ref, practice call in that game, so all of this evens out. No, it doesn't. You got one of the, you got two of the most egregious series-changing calls in recent NHL history, and they like they wouldn't accept that that's what happened. They're like, well, no, actually, we really got screwed over in that game. You look the whole thing. Shut the fuck up. You know, it just, I'm so glad that they lost. It just, that was some, God, I mean, come on. If that team won the Stanley Cup, how bad would that look? You win because of a phantom 5-minute major? Because the Knights had them beat. They had them absolutely beat. The Sharks hadn't generated jack shit in that game. And then it's a 5-minute major because Pavelski went down weird. And boom, 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 and somehow the Knights came back and tied the game, but then they lost in overtime. So thank God the Sharks are out. I will give you a pretty – well, I'll touch on the Blues real quickly. You know, the Blues, they didn't make the playoffs last year, which was surprising. But what's really changed for them, because if you look at, like, the last 5 or 6 years in hockey, every year they've had a team – they can absolutely go up against anyone toe-for-toe, 5-on-5. They could play with anyone. But they've always been sunk by terrific goaltending, whether it was Brian Elliott or Jake Allen. They all suck. And then this Binnington kid comes in halfway through the season, and he just gets on a roll, and now they actually have competent goaltending. So I can't say I'm all that shocked that the Blues have gotten this far, although you could have looked at this and said, you know, the Blues, maybe their core, this team that's been so solid like for the last 5 years, maybe their time has passed, but clearly that wasn't the case. So Binnington really turned things around. The emergence of Robert Thomas has been pretty big. So, should be an interesting finals. I will say that I'll take the Bruins in six.
I think that's a good prediction. I don't want to, I mean, as much as I can appreciate the Blues run towards this, the Stanley Cup final, that seems like a pretty much where I'm going to go to. Now, here's an interesting fact. The Blues haven't been to the Stanley Cup final since 1970. In that 1970 final, they played, can you guess, Mike?
In 1970?
Yeah,
1970. They played the Boston Bruins.
They did.
It was the Bobby Orr goal.
That's right.
Where
that's it.
The picture where he's flying through the air.
Mm-hmm. The famous Bobby Orr flying in the air photo from when he scored the game-winning goal in that. But now, what they don't really tell you is that that was a sweep, but it's still pretty cool to kind of see that visual. So isn't that funny?
Well, Dave, you know how the NHL was structured for a few years when they expanded, right? Like this is something that you would have sworn that only Gary Bettman could have come up with because it's just so hilariously stupid.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, putting all the expansion teams into one conference, so the Stanley Cup Finals was a foregone conclusion.
It's true. That is true. I was wondering, how did the Blues end up making it to the final after only like a year? And then it's like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, well, there you go. So that is pretty dumb, I gotta admit. Yeah. It's almost like you put an asterisk on all those championships, right? Like from like 1968.
Well, no, not really, because none of those Western teams ever won. So the Eastern teams always had to you know, they always had to get through the other Eastern teams, but then they switched it up. So, like, you had in the 70s, you had a Boston Bruins New York Rangers Stanley Cup final.
That's
which,
right. Yeah.
You know, I almost wish they would seed like 1 through 16 so we could like see something like that again. It'd be pretty cool.
I always wondered about that when I was young. Like, I was always wondering, like, how did the Kings end up playing Toronto for the conference championship back in 93? And that's just how it was back then. They just, there was never necessarily a specific geographic alignment with the conferences in those days. So I would not be against that either. I think we can just do away with conferences and just do 1 through 16. And it's a lot better than what they're doing now. It's essentially just like teams are just playing their own division until the conference final, Mike.
No, the way they're doing it now is stupid. One of the ideas of playoff hockey is that it's this war of attrition. You've already played 82 regular season games. And a big part of getting through is having the depth to being able to withstand a couple injuries or have guys that, you know, can play through nagging shit or something like that. But what I don't like is that I feel like having these big matchups potentially early on kind of like takes away from it.
Right.
Now, granted, even with the 1-8, 2-7, if you get a hot team in the right spot, like with the LA Kings back in 2012, you could still get a tough matchup early. But at least on paper, it's more fair. And also this whole idea that, well, we need to promote these division rivalries. Listen, your division rivals and your geographic rivals are already rivals because of geography specifically. When you start, if you run into someone who, like, let's say, isn't necessarily geographically a rival, but you play each other in the playoffs like 3 times in 5 years, you become rivals. So
right.
I just really think that what the NHL has done is kind of misguided.
Right.
And they've been lucky that they haven't hit this real doomsday scenario where, because the way it works is both division winners automatically get in. And then the 2 and 3 in each conference automatically gets in. Well, one of these years, the team that finishes third in a particular division is going to have a worse record than a team that fails to qualify for the playoffs because of that system where the top three in each division automatically gets in. And once that happens, I think there might be enough blowback. It's been on pace to happen a couple times, but it hasn't quite happened. But I guarantee you one of these years that's going to happen, and the league's really going to have egg on their face.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think of that. That would be a disaster if that were to go down. Good thinking, John. I wanted to come back to you on an NFL question. Some announcements today. Number one, they determined that the divisional round will now move back. So they used to be at 1. The Sunday of the divisional round used to be 1 o'clock Eastern and 4:30 Eastern. It's been that way for many years, like as long as I've been born, practically. Now they have probably long overdue in some cases, but I think it's a shame myself. But they moved them to, I think it was like 3 and 6:30. So that's number one. Number two, they did away with the blackout for single header networks if the home team was playing on the other network. Or no. I think it's the scenario is, if a home team's playing on one network, you don't get blacked out from the game on the other network. So everybody gets 3 games a week now. So that's a very interesting wrinkle, and I like that one. But I wanted to get your thoughts on these NFL scheduling changes.
I saw that come across the news feed earlier about the time changes for the divisional round on Sunday anyway. I don't know. I feel like, on one hand, I like it for competitive reasons because, like we saw this year with the Chargers, I mean, it's kind of unfair for a team to have to – they came to Baltimore the week before on the East Coast, went back to L.A., and then came back to New England to play a 1 o'clock game. Now, you know, I'm not going to say if the game was played at 3 o'clock. I mean, the Chargers were going to win. I mean, I think the Patriots had that game won before it started the way it played out. But I just think for a competitive – advantage scenario, I think that's much more of a fair situation. In terms of just being a fan, I think the conference championships being the only games at 3 and 6:30, and it kind of makes them unique and special. And I don't think it's going to be you're not going to have that now if the divisional round, if they're doing that on Sunday. So, for that standpoint, anyway, I don't like the move. I'm sure they did all sorts of data and looked at this and said, all right, well, you have the most people watching TV at this time, which I don't doubt. I mean, those conference championship games got huge ratings, especially the Chiefs-Patriots game that went into overtime. I think half the East Coast was, like, snowed in anyway, too. So, I mean, that certainly played a role. But, you know, I'm not a huge fan of it. Obviously, we'll watch. But I think they did it because of that and because of the competitive advantage scenario, like I mentioned. I think in terms of that anyway, it's a good idea, but, you know, I probably wouldn't have done it. I like keeping it at the 4 and 8 and then the 1 and 4 on the first 2 weekends. And then, okay, for the conference championships, if you want to push it back, I'm okay with that. But I really don't like it that much for the divisional round.
Oh, very good. But what about now? What about the abolition of the doubleheader blackout rule? Because now that's something we probably don't see very much. But if you happen to be just a guy that watches only the local game, do you feel like that's long overdue? What's your feeling on that new legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I really never come across that situation. I mean, our local team here, I guess, is the Patriots, and honestly, like, I'm watching like Red Zone, or I'll be watching a stream of the Green Bay game. So I usually don't like, I'm not watching like the local broadcast. But I mean, any scenario, I've read the horror stories of how, you know, how you can't watch one window because your local team is playing at the other window on the other network. So any change that allows people to watch more games without having to pay is a good situation. So I think that was a good move, on their part. I'm assuming you get this all the time in LA now.
Yeah.
With two teams.
It's an interesting thought. No, I think they were making exceptions to that in some weeks. If you remember, like, there are some weeks where the LA, for whatever reason, got four games. And what they would do is they would put like one of them on another channel completely. Like they put it on channel 13 or some weird channel. But for the most part, you're right. It's a complication. And I feel like this rule was invented because of the LA market. It does make sense because they both play in the late window when they play at home. So it opens up flexibility from that standpoint. Because they were having a whale of a time trying to schedule all those games with like two teams that could potentially both be on the West Coast at the same time. That creates a lot of problems for NFL scheduling. So I think that had a lot to do with it. You're right.
Yeah, I'm sure it was always a dance now where you have two teams. And like you said, you can't play one of them at 10 a.m. your time. So, I'm sure that's, and they, I don't know how many weeks of last year that they both played at 4:25. You have to look at that, but I'm sure for that situation and for New York too, that they, this is definitely going to help those markets and get people extra games, which is a good scenario. So I'm okay with that change.
All right. Back to Mike, we'll do final thoughts. And I'd like to get your prediction for the NBA finals. We assume it's going to be Milwaukee, but you can certainly do one for Toronto just in case they win.
Oh, NBA final. Well, see, this is a tough one to do because we got a couple of variables in here.
Right, right.
Is it Milwaukee or is it Toronto? And what's the status of Durant?
Right.
So if Durant's in, no matter who they play, there'll be four or five games going to State. If Durant's out, unless someone else goes down, and it'll be interesting to see if Iguodala is actually hurt, because I know he missed the the game four. But they just seem to really be on a mission here. Because I do think they kind of know that Durant's got half a foot out the door. Not to say that Durant isn't, trying his best when he's out there on the court. The guy definitely wants to win. He's a great player. But I do think that this sort of galvanized them a little bit. So I think no matter who Golden State plays, I think I'd have – well, they're going to be on the road for no matter who they play.
That's
but
right.
I would say Golden State without Durant, Golden State in six against either Toronto or Milwaukee. That would be my prediction.
All right. I'm going to take I don't want to get too bold. I probably will go Golden State in six. John said Golden State in five or six as well. So very good. And let me go back to John and let's get your final thoughts for, and you can go back to the PGA stuff too. Final thoughts for tonight.
Yeah. It was a exciting tournament, especially, when you head into the final round with one player has a 7-shot lead. I mean, you think to yourself, oh man, how are they going to fill the last 2 hours of the broadcast? Is it going to be, Gary McCord cracking jokes for a couple hours? And, luckily, that scenario didn't manifest itself, and we had an exciting finish, and Koepka hung on, and it was a good tournament. And like we talked about, I think the move to May for the PGA Championship was a positive one for now, and we'll see where it goes from here. And we're really looking forward now. The countdown is on to the U.S. Open in 3 weeks. So it's a great time for golf, and good to be here to discuss it all. So good stuff. Thanks for having us on, Dave.
Absolutely. Yeah, you bet. It's fun to do these shows all the time, and to do them all like within a smaller window is definitely interesting. And I was very intrigued to see how we would do with the last major so fresh in our mind. This is definitely a first for us. So it was very exciting to prepare for the show, and doing it was just as fun. So let's go to Mike and get your final thoughts.
Yeah, well, it's always fun discussing golf with you guys. I always enjoy it, but it never feels like, I'm obliged to do this. It's always fun to sit here and discuss it with you. So, to echo what John said, it kind of looked like that we were going to see a 2011 and 2014 U.S. Open last week at Bethpage Black, where McIlroy in 2011 and Martin Keimer in 2014 had everything well in hand, and the last nine holes were just a coronation. But that wasn't the case. We got a little bit of drama, but Koepka did hold on and win. And a bit of a unique circumstance in that if Koepka had folded, this would have been like a rather historic occurrence. And in winning, it was a rather historic occurrence because of what we've touched upon, the four majors in his last eight starts, three in his last five. He is now the two-time defending PGA and U.S. Open champion simultaneously, which I believe is the first time in history that's ever happened. So just an incredible accomplishment. And yeah, this condensed schedule, we're already on to the U.S. Open countdown. So obviously looking forward to that and the beautiful scenery at Pebble Beach and being able to do the recap with you guys in a few weeks.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. So thanks again, fellas. It was a blast doing this program again. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you guys soon. Thanks, and take care.
All right, Dave. See you.
Take care, guys. Bye, Mike. Take care. That's our show. That's Mike. That's John. I'm Dave. Good times. We hope you enjoyed it tonight. If you're looking for our other, for our Masters recap that's earlier in our feed, just go to Dave in the City Out West on Apple Podcasts and look for it. Or go to our website, ditcow.com, or look us up on Twitter, @ditcow. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you next time.